Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the Fail to Fail podcast with your host, Don Abernathy.
What is going on, everybody? It has been a long time since we've gotten around to another episode of the Fail to Fail podcast, the Digital 410 Network's limited series motivational podcast. But we have a guest for you tonight. Like you guys know, we usually save the nice guest, the deep guest, the unique guest for this podcast. And we've done that once again. If you're a TikToker like myself, you may follow him at Punks Not Dad. Joining us from the Great White North, Mr. Jarrett Fleming. Jarrett, how are you doing today, sir?
Very well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you you coming in and hanging out with us. Before we get to the jux of the position, why I'm having you on, let's get a little bit of background for everybody. Give me a little background. Where'd you grow up? What era did you grow up in? What was your childhood like?
For sure. I was, I'm 42 now. I was born in 1980, just missed the 70s, glory days of punk rock in 1977. But I was born into a conservative hockey family in Winnipeg, Manitoba. My father was a coach of the local university hockey team there, and he went on to serve as coach and several positions for Hockey Canada, as well as several teams across the NHL, the KHL in Russia, and the Elite Serien in Sweden as well. So, you know, life of a hockey coach. When I say I lived in several places, people typically ask me if I was an Army brat.
I was going to say it's very reminiscent to the lifestyle and the childhood of an Army brat for sure.
That's right. So we actually, our first big move out of Winnipeg, Manitoba, in the Canadian Prairies was to a small town in the northern Italian mountains of Murano, Italy in 1986. Dad took a job there. And I think that's what really started, you know, he was known in within hockey as the Indiana Jones of hockey, because he was really everywhere in any given year. You know, that was, we were out there before the fall of the Berlin Wall. I was in grade one out there.
Wow.
We're so far north. I was actually in German school, picked up a little bit of German. I'm still able to order a bratwurst if I'm over there.
I wish I would have paid more attention in my German class in high school, because where I live in Cape Coral, Florida, we are real big. We are a big tourist destination for Germans. And when I had my IT firm, I had 4 or 5 German clients. Luckily, I have Windows memorized well enough that I could sort through it, even though it's all in German. But, you know, I can speak very little German, but I wish I would have paid a hell of a lot more attention in high school, because that's the one language class I did take, but I never finished. And there is a huge population of German tourists down here.
Oh, yeah. Well, my oldest sister, Angie, actually moved to East Germany in the early 90s, got married, and my oldest nieces and nephews, all fluent in English, German, French, and they spent some time in Dubai as well, so they have a little bit of Arabic. So we're definitely a well-traveled family.
Well, I don't want to get full-blown into a history podcast, because that's what the Scuttlebutt's for, but just briefly, explain the importance and the magnitude of living where you lived when the Berlin Wall was coming down or had just come down. I mean, that was world-changing, literally. I mean, more than just the David Hasselhoff video that we all love to this day. I mean, that was a big deal.
Yeah, you know, as a kid, you know, from Winnipeg, which is a pretty, you know, we had a NHL team at the time. They've since come back. The Winnipeg Jets, but you know, I was easily the most world traveled in my grade two class, I think.
Absolutely.
At the time, and it really helped me along the way as far as growing myself into who I am and having a pretty broad perspective of life outside of a Canadian prairie town. You know, it was obviously intimidating. The world was a lot bigger then than it is now. So, you know, my teachers didn't speak a lick of English, and we just threw ourselves into these adventures. And, you know, I tell you what, though, it was something I'd never trade for the world. And obviously I was super fortunate to have these opportunities, especially to see so much of the world before I had to grow up and pay for it all.
Yeah, right.
Well, but yeah, you know, yeah, it was, it's something that, was very, very fortunate. Being at such a young age, I didn't understand the fact that it was a unique opportunity at the time. But in hindsight, it was something that definitely shaped me.
And for the people listening might think, well, God, that sucks, not having any grounding or continuity, being at the same high school, same middle school. But that's such a short period, but an important period in your life. But not only that, I think looking back now, you definitely appreciate the fact that, as you were just saying, moving to all these places, living amongst all these different cultures and all these physical environments, it's so well-rounding for one's personality. I mean, I by no means lived on the scale which you did, but I grew up, born in Kentucky, grew up in Ohio, spent 4 years in California, and I've been in Florida for 20 years now. But just living in those four different states and those four different areas, and during those moves, I'm much like you, a lot of it was driving, a lot of it was flying, but driving through the country, I tell people all the time, there is plenty of middle of nowhere still left out there. I mean, it's out there, but sometimes I and my brother's the same way. Ohio, Montana, where he lived in Big Sky for 8 years, snowboarding. Now he lives out in Vegas. And then I think of some of our friends back home who never left the town we grew up in. It's like, how much are they missing? And not only that, but just their opinions, the way they see things. When you move and you live amongst different people, because every state, every country, every location has a different populace, and that populace has a different way of thinking. And thus, by you living in those different areas, it makes you a more rounded person, opposed to living in one area your entire life and having the same views.
Yeah, and that's the beautiful thing about, the 50 states spread out across America down there is, boy, you guys have a lot of culture under one flag. And, we're a large country geographically up here, but I think maybe there's 35 million people. When I was growing up, there was 25, 26 million people. So, and all most of us are all tucked in very close to the U.S. border.
Yeah.
For the most part, spread out between Montreal, Toronto, and Vancouver. There was relatively a humble population of us throughout the prairies. But, I spent most of the last 10 years, my wife's son and I moved to Regina, Saskatchewan, 3 years ago now, just under 3 years ago. And we spent majority of the last 10 years in Victoria on Vancouver Island, just off the coast of Vancouver, BC. And, it's really heaven on earth as far as Canada goes. It really is our Florida, where it has the best climate year round for our country. And, mountains and ocean and whales. And because of that fact, you really, I met a lot of the population out there that grew up there and never saw, never saw much of Canada.
Yeah.
Really saw no reason to leave because of such natural beauty out there. And it really, I talk about my international experiences, but I've been fortunate enough to live in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and BC throughout my childhood and adulthood. Coming back to the prairies after being gone for 30 years, I'm just, I fell in love with it again, and it seems to be where my heart is right now. There's something to be said about Big Sky Country. And,
yeah.
The freedom, on Vancouver Island, if somebody gets a flat tire, the whole island is shut down for hours, if not days. And there's only one road up and one road down. The same scenario happens out here, and you make a left turn onto a gravel road and carry on with your life. And there's just something to be said about that. But the people out here are phenomenal, and it's part of the reason why we moved back here was to, have this, my son's grandparents' influence on him, and really the small town local experience that exists out here to be, part of his influence growing up as well.
I was just thinking, you're talking about, there somebody car breaks down, it brings the traffic to a standstill. Well, we have the same problem down here, but it's not because of narrow thoroughfares, it's because people are lazy. I was thinking, I was born in 78. You were born in 80. You know as well as I did, cars were garbage in the 80s up until the mid-90s unless you had money. And so anybody who had a car, whether it was a 98 Ford Escort, a Chevette, a early model Honda, those things broke down. You never knew if you're going to get to work on time, your fuel pump's going to go out, your alternator's going to fail. We all spent a lot of time jumping our cars in first gear and pushing them off the road, right?
Very much so.
People down here run out of gas or something, they could be driving a Kia Rio and they will not get out and push that damn thing. They will just let it sit in the traffic. One day there was a guy who had a little MG Boxer, two-seater convertible, sitting right by a church parking lot entrance. And then we have what we call the Cape Coral Voice. They're retirees who volunteer to be kind of like assistants to the police. So whenever there's an accident, they do traffic control. Whenever there's DUI checkpoints, they stand around as witnesses. And so the voice officer has his little car parked there with his lights on, and now they're blocking two lanes of traffic. So I pulled into the parking lot, and I asked the guy, I said, does neutral work? Oh, yeah. I can help you. It was like literally 5 feet into the parking lot instead of blocking two lanes out of three-lane traffic. Oh, no, tow truck's here now. Guy had been standing out there for 20 minutes because neither him nor the voice guy wanted to push this little two-seater spider 20 feet up into a parking lot. It's one of those things that just blows my mind. Like cars, we would push a Buick Skylark. The thing was a tank, and you'd have one guy in a flip-flop pushing in neutral down an icy road because we at least made the attempt. Not anymore. So, you know, our traffic shuts down too with broken down cars.
Well, those struggles made for great memories for sure. My first vehicle was a 1984 Jetta that the alternator was gone. So for the first several months, I couldn't afford to change anything of it. I got a deal on it, and I pushed started that thing and had to, you know, park on hills just so that I could pop it into first.
My brother did the same thing with his Dodge Omni because his battery was dead. So he would park it so he could jump start it and run it off the alternator.
Days.
Oh, it's so funny. Growing up, you know, poor in Kentucky and Ohio, and as I went to school out in California for computers, my dream car was a Volkswagen Jetta. I'm like, ooh, it's a poor man's BMW. It's a poor man's a Mercedes. Right. Fast forward, I'm like 35, man, no lady. She's like, we're getting our first new car. I was like, what kind of car do you want? I don't know. Let's go look at Jettas. We're on our third one now. Sadly, it's our last one. All three of our Jettas are 2008, our 2012, and our 2018. I've replaced radios in all three of them. My 2008, as soon as I paid off, the AC went up. The one I have now, the lease, is just up 40,000 miles. The heated seat has already gone out. The radio has been replaced twice. The backup camera is not working now. The AC recirculator just shuts off after 2 miles here in Florida, which isn't good. And like the thing has 40,000. It's basically brand new. So I've lost complete faith in Volkswagen. But I didn't bring you on here to slam on Volkswagen. It's just I'm a Volkswagen guy. I'm a Volkswagen Toyota guy. I'm very brand loyal. And so it hurts me when I have to turn my back on one, especially Volkswagen. But let me ask you this. I know, and people who know who watch your TikToks, skateboarding, snowboarding, and punk rock music plays a big part in your life. But a lot of people wouldn't think, with the exception of snowboarding, which really didn't come into its high days until early 2000s. Where does a boy shuffling around, following his hockey coach in Canada, pick up on skateboarding and punk rock? I can't imagine, especially back in the 90s. Nowadays, it's a whole different story. Every town has a skate park. But when we were growing up, it was getting ran out of parking lots, parking garages, having the police line you up and because they think you're up to no good. They think you got drugs on you. How did you get into the punk music and skateboard world in the 80s and 90s going around Canada?
Yeah, you know, so like I said, my dad took a job with Hockey Canada in 1990, which moved us from Winnipeg to the headquarters of Hockey Canada at the time, and still is, in Calgary, Alberta. And just, you know what, serendipitously, Calgary was also the unofficial headquarters for snowboarding at that time. Two brothers, Ken and Dave Achenbach, owned the world's first snowboard-only snowboard shop. You know, there's other shops that, you know, ski shops and what have you that carried snowboards, but they were the first core snowboard shop, I believe, in the world. And Ken went on to open up the summer camp for snowboarding on the Whistler Glacier a couple years later. And you know, just that Calgary was still a small town at the time, you know, a city, but to have something that new kind of in your backyard, and growing up as a hockey kid, you know, hockey was so established at the time. And for me, it was just part of everyday life that it lost a little bit of its flair. And maybe I didn't even know until, you know, I saw some, you know, goofy haired kids at the local ski hill. And it was just something that I was so attracted to because it was just so out of left field for my everyday life. And like I said, it was right there. So I was fortunate enough that I got my hands on a snowboard, got my hands on a skateboard, much to my parents' chagrin, got my hands on some early punk rock tapes. And
I bet you can name the deck, the trucks you had, whether or not you had fat riser pads or skinny ones, and what brand bearings you had, because you grew up in the 90s, so I know they were German bearings. You probably didn't have Bones Brigade yet. But every one of them.
Yeah, you know what? Everything I got from, you know, if I ever needed a hockey, you know, hockey stick or skates or anything, it was, you know, whatever is top of the line and yep. brand new and accessible to my dad at the time, I'd have it. They had no interest in really providing me with these materials, especially for skateboarding. So literally my first deck was a Santa Cruz Slick. It still had a squared tail, even though they were starting to move into, you know, the twin tip shape that we all kind of know now. Gullwing trucks and
Gull Wings were borderline budget pro model skate trucks. They weren't independents, they were Gull Wing.
Yeah, well, and you know, good rule of thumb back then, if they weren't indies, they were crap. So you know, and my bearings, you know what, like I didn't even know what bearings were. It took my friends to show me how to pop them out of some roller skates wheels at a garage sale that we found. So it was very much a Frankenstein skateboard deck that I first got on top of. And you know, fortunately my dad did shell out for a snowboard from the snowboard shop. It was used, and you know what, the gear back then was changing every single year. So mm-hmm. if you got a snowboard that was 2 years old at the time,
mm-hmm.
your friends definitely knew. And I looked pretty goofy for the first few years out there. And you know, it was something that really was kind of in my back pocket. I didn't throw my whole life into it until we moved to Sweden in 1992. And when we got to Sweden, the culture there, I don't know, just the kids were just so open and allowed to participate in everything. So there really wasn't these clicky subcultures where, you know, the hockey guys didn't skate or the skaters didn't play hockey. Really, everybody was throwing themselves into anything they could. And we did have a small local hill that actually produced a couple of relatively known pro snowboarders at the time in Fred and Magnus Sterner. And I played with their younger cousin and son, brother, Stefan Sterner, in hockey. And, you know, again, like I just, for whatever reason, I had these influences at my fingertips and this very alternative from hockey activity.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had some decent, you know, natural athletic ability, and I was able to progress somewhat quickly in both those sports.
Well, it's funny because I started skating in second grade. Some of the older kids in my neighborhood was, I got a hold of Vision Streetwear. Oh, I forget which videotape it was. It was the one that had Christian Soy doing the King Air contest. Now, for those of you at home, I'm not making fun of the man for having Gullwing trucks. I'm laughing because my first pro model board was the Steve Caballero White Dragon with Gullwing trucks, German bearings. Because back in the day, there was two bearing companies. There were German bearings or Swiss bearings. That was it. There wasn't a Bones. There wasn't Shorties. You didn't have all these different lines. It was, oh, you want German bearings. No, you want Swiss bearings. And I'm Googling it because 10 years ago, I could have told you exactly what wheels they were. I think they may have been bullet wheels. Straight line budget stuff. But yeah, Gullwing trucks, first model. And it was the Steve Caballero Mini. It's actually when they made the mini board. Because once again, I was in second grade. And so, yep. From then on, it was, you know, Dead Milkman, skateboarding. You're talking about, you know, the transition from the fishtail flat nose to what we have now, the the double-ended boards. Do you remember one of the first models to make that change?
Well, I believe it's credited to Mike Vallely. Mike Vallely. When we grew up, there wasn't podcasts. So whatever a skater's name was in a magazine, it was however you read it.
However you read it in Thrasher or Trans World.
That's right. And there was a whole generation of us that read it as Mike Vallely.
Now, I don't know. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm just saying, yeah, he came onto the Nine Club a year or two ago, another podcast, and corrected pretty much the whole skate world and said, no, my name is Mike Vallely. And listeners might know him from CKY2. And he's the guy that messed up four guys in the parking lot that were picking fights with skaters.
Do you remember the old Omar Hassan video where he had the broken arm and he was in a parking lot and these guys, he took out four guys with a broken arm. Omar Hassan is the only skateboarder who got Thrasher Skate of the Year 3 years in a row and had a broken arm in every damn photo because he just kept breaking that. When I lived in Columbus, he came through Dodge Skate Park a few times and that boy could shred.
Yeah.
But
he took Switch skateboarding to really from its very basics to a whole new level that, you know, very few people could touch for years.
I don't know if it was great marketing, if there's any truth to it, but do you remember the Vision Double Deck?
I don't. That was probably before my time. Vision, and if you pull this out, I'm going to be psyched.
This is an original. This isn't the new reprint. This is... When I was in third grade, this board came out. This wasn't mine. I didn't have Vision Double Deck money. I had 8th Street money. And in the 90s, I was riding Beer City. But right around the time I graduated, the guy I went to school with since second grade, who lived in the neighborhood where I started skateboarding, bought this at a yard sale, complete. And then when I'm 6'5". I was 175 pounds. But for the younger audience, in the 90s, skateboarding was at an all-time low. No one was skating. If you were skateboarding, people just assumed you're a drug addict or into bad things. We didn't have skate parks everywhere, as we said at the beginning. People just thought you were a ne'er-do-well. And so I don't know if it's conspiracy. I don't know if they did it kind of like automotive companies do, wear and tear parts. But skateboard decks got super flimsy in the 90s. Now, some of them could say, oh, we wanted to make them lighter so you can do your double varial kickflips easier. No, they were breaking. And you'd go out and you would step through a board quickly. So when my buddy Terry showed up with this, I borrowed it. Still had it had in full-size independent trucks on, which you can't find hangers that wide anymore. You're lucky to find – I'm sure they're reprinting them now. But I actually looked to outfit this in about 2012, and I could not find hangers wide enough. But I started skating this because it held my big 6'5" ass frame and my feet didn't hang over it. And I could still do, as you can see, the nose slides, the tail slides and all that stuff and not sit there and break boards every other day. Sadly, I let my brother's friend borrow that and he never returned it. And then I found it 2 years later in my buddy's basement stripped down. So he basically borrowed it, stole all the trucks and wheels off of it and left in my buddy's basement. But yes, I do have an original. I want to say 1989 Vision Double Deck.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to understate how massive Vision was at the time too, and as a metaphor for how much skateboarding changed in such a short period of time, you know, fast forward a few years and a company that was made almost purely in contrast to Vision was Blind Skateboards, owned by Steve Rocco.
Yep.
And you know, when Blind Video Days with Mark Gonzalez and you know, future movie star Jason Lee mm-hmm. came out, holy shit, you know, that just changed the way that we all perceive skateboarding and what was capable on a skateboard. And and then, you know, shortly a year or two after that, Plan B dropped two videos that just made Blind Video Days look like it was ancient material. So, you know, it's...
Well, because before all that came out, before everybody was doing the kick flips, the heel slides and all that stuff, the biggest, craziest thing we'd see is Nadas Kappas doing a 360 off the top of a fire hydrant. I mean, that was the craziest trick we saw. And then fast forward to the 90s, real small wheels so that you can land these crazy tricks and your boards don't go rocketing out from underneath you. So the boards got thinner, they got lighter, and the wheels got super small. They're almost barely bigger than the diameter of the bearings that they were in, especially after they wore condoms. Down. It was crazy. But and so you got into the skate world, and then obviously having access to some of the best freaking ski resorts in the Western Hemisphere, snowboarding started to develop, and you got into that, which the transition is very much the same. Carving's a little closer to surfing, but I mean, if you could skateboard, you spent a week and a half on a snowboard. Don't plan to do anything else because you won't be able to walk after day two. But it was the world as far as the camaraderie and the whole environment of snowboarding and skateboarding went hand in hand. When I got my first 1993 Burton snowboard in Ohio, we actually had to call to the ski resorts to see if they even allowed you on there, because most of them, snowboarders were bad. They were, you know, connotations. Yes. So maybe one out of the six resorts in Ohio and Kentucky would actually allow you to take your stuff there. And so when I started, you go to the hill, you may see 50 snowboarders and like 300 skiers. Now it's completely flip-flopped.
Yeah, you know, boy, at the time, and skateboarding really saved snowboarding. You know, there was a time in the 80s there where, other than Terry Kidwell, snowboarding was pretty goofy. You know, we had the Santa Claus toques and the neon, and you know, Damian Sanders, as incredibly talented as he was, you know, he was really hard to look at. You know, hard ski boots on and sniper narrow stance. And, you know, it took a few guys to really adapt. You know, Noah Slasnik came out of the skateboard world, and, you know, he had a goofy Santa Claus toque for a couple of years. But, you know, him and John Cardell.
Not to cut you off, but for those listening at home, it was almost like people were dressing in case they got stuck in an avalanche. It was the brightest neon, most insane crap you could possibly find at the mall. And they weren't even hipsters. They weren't doing it ironically. They did it because neon was in. It was cool. It was futuristic. And so you would just see these, and they would clash. They have a neon pink jacket with a neon orange pant, and then, like you said, a neon green Santa Claus hat with a big bobber on the end. And it was the most absurd, obnoxious thing you saw coming down the hill. And then, sadly, that's the way the media, cartoons, and especially commercials for kids, everything in the 80s and 90s, that if it had a board, whether it was a skateboard, a snowboard, or a surfboard, everybody talked like Spicoli from Fast Times, which is why Michelangelo talks like that, because Hollywood is lazy, and they just, okay, from here on out, every skater, snowboarder, ha-ha, dude, like the walls and Mahler, telly-telly tall, like for sure, dude, ha-ha, telly-telly. And they used to, being a guy from Kentucky who was fighting a hillbilly act, it's like, I didn't know anybody talked like that, all the skaters. So to me, that made me cringe when I would see that representation on TV and in movies.
Oh, it's wild, you know, and even, you know, it took well until the 2000s for mainstream media to cover even the shape of skateboards and snowboards to a relatively contemporary style. You know, Bart Simpson was on a squared tail. Nope. He probably still is. And yeah, I haven't watched an episode of The Simpsons in forever. But I think it was pretty easy to make fun of how whack that style really was. And we, you know, ultimately I think that the European riders were the last to transition. and we just called it Euro style through the early
Euro
90s. But Burton, you know, it really was the skateboarders that, that not only saved, you know, snowboarding and turned it into what it was, you know, in not only tricks, but dress and, you know, everything became the opposite. Like, if you're going to wear that tight neon stuff, then we're going to wear
tones,
as big of black pants as we can. We're going to wear big plaid shirts.
Or even, you know, Burton went streamlined.
We're going to dress like a skier. We're going to make fun of skiers. And, you know, you can't go back to those days. It was something very unique. But also, you know, we were, like you said, we weren't allowed at every ski resort. And there was almost this, like, instinctual crossover of the mainstream to treat us like, you know, police treated skateboarders in those early days. So And I had again, it was part of the fun.
And for those who watch on YouTube, I had a camcorder that was bigger than this keyboard. And so when we would snowboard down the hill, you were doing one of these jobs because it literally had a full-size VHS tape in it. Or if you were real cool and real confident, you would zoom all the way out and you'd hold it by the handle and do it like the pro skaters do, and you hold it down by your hip. But we didn't have GoPros. We did, I mean, and the battery life on that thing was maybe 20 minutes on a good day. And so it was hard to even produce skate videos and snowboard videos back then. But real quick, before we transition into the main reason why you're on here.
Yes.
I've always said, like, if I was going to be a professor, like in a marketing class, or teach up-and-comers about marketing and what not to do, Airwalk would be my keynote on how to turn your back against your demographic and watch your company just die.
They had the industry and, you know, us as kids, they had our full attention.
They were the Nike of skateboarding world. They were named after a skateboarding move. At the time, you either had Vision Streetwears, Vans, or Airwalks, and that was it.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's actually by the time I was in grade 8, Vans were, they couldn't be less cool. Nobody really rocked them until Jeff Rowley brought them back from the dead. Maybe in the late 90s, but
I want to stand a band real quick. You know who I credit to the mainstream popularity of Vans outside of the skateboard world? Big Bang Theory. The set producers funny. And the wardrobe said, okay, we got a group of nerds, and this is before nerds were cool. We need to dress them outlandish. So they put them in bright red skinny jeans. Vans had these bright red, goofy, silly-looking shoes. And so you had this entire generation grew up watching these great guys on Big Bang Theory, and that's why Comic-Con blew up. That's why Vans blew up. That's why skinny jeans, because these kids were looking up to what our generation, the set producers and the writers, made up to be, you know, nerds or scientists. And these kids look at them like they're heroes. And I believe that's why Comic-Con's as big as it is. That's why Vans are as big as they are. And that's why there was a period of dressing weird and wearing skinny pants, because they're all dressing like Howard from Big Bang Theory. And to this day, I credit them for the nerd culture and the popularity in which it is now.
It took me a very long time to get rid of my massive jeans. I was well into my 20s wearing very big pants.
Well, the other thing I'm resentful for about that is the skateboarders, at least in the 90s, we were all just going to thrift stores. I was a size 28. I looked like a heroin addict, but I was buying 35 waist pants, and I was cinching them back, and they're super big, and I was cutting them off. And then here comes mainstream pop culture. Oh, look what the skate kids are doing. JNCO. And so everybody credits JNCO. No, JNCO was just ripping off the skateboard kids who were going to the thrift store and buying pants for $2 that were too big for them. And so it's amazing how much of pop culture, at least in the late 90s, early 2000s, the skate culture created, even though people didn't want to admit it because they looked down on us so much.
Yeah, well, and again, like you look at how quickly MTV had a massive hit with the Jackass series. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, with Tremaine and Pontius, and those guys were all from Big Brother magazine, yeah. Right? And Dave England, you know, he was pro snowboarder when I was a kid. I didn't think he was going to end up doing podcasts and being, you know, well recognized by the mainstream.
CKY2K.
It's absolutely wild.
Real quick, back to my Airwalk thing for the people who don't know what I'm talking about. Airwalk was a skate shoe. It was around skate. It was developed around. It was the go-to skateboarding shoe. But as I said earlier, in the 90s, skateboarding was dying. The money was being lost. And so somebody over at Airwalk said, hey, extreme is the new catchphrase. Everything's about base jumping. It's about base jumping, surfing, bungee jumping is a big thing. And so Airwalk changed their whole scheme. They dropped skateboarding for every advertising. They dropped the word skateboarding from their shoe in the catalogs. And all their footage was base jumping, bungee jumping, surfing. You don't need to wear shoes when you surf. But they went down that whole thing. And I remember I was at SunSports. SunSports was like the local mom and pop shop. They had like 4 or 5 shops in a skate park in Columbus, indoor skate park, which was unheard of back then. I remember Nick, who ran the Dublin store, came up to us and said, would you guys care if we stopped carrying Airwalk products? We're like, no, they turned their back on skateboarding 2 years ago. And everybody across the industry did that now, where before they closed, the only place you could find Airwalks to this day was Payless Shoes, because they literally turned their back on being like the Nike of the skateboard industry. Because there was a rough patch in the 90s. And at least at the time, even when Vans blew up and you saw them in Sears catalog, they still said Vans skateboarding shoes. They never lost their way and they never dropped skateboarding. And the skateboarding community has always appreciated them for that. Unlike DC shoe when Nike bought them out, now they're just, you know, whatever shoe.
Yeah, you know what? And speaking of Nike, while I have this platform right now,
please, I'm an Adidas guy.
I was gone, and we'll get into this later, but I was wasted for a few years. And I don't know when Nike got accepted by the skateboard culture of kids. But, you know, when I was growing up, there was actually the best thing Nike did in the 90s, or maybe it was the early 2000s. I think it was late 90s. And it was a university student, marketing student out of University of Alberta, I believe, in Edmonton, who came up with the commercial ideology for Nike. And it was, what if, and by all means, listeners, YouTube this, Nike, what if we treated all athletes like we treat our skateboarders?
I'm not aware of this. I'll have
Please
to look it up.
Check it out.
I'll include I'll find it, and when I post this on the failtofail.com, I'll include the videos underneath the video link for this. So you guys can go to failtofail.com or d-410.com, and we'll link the videos up there. But go
yeah,
ahead.
Please check it out. It's fantastically funny and clever. But even with commercial as clever as that, it still took, you know, another 10 or 15 years for Nike to really be accepted by skateboarding and by snowboarding for that matter, you know, and it's a hard pill for me to swallow after supporting all these small brands, throughout my, you know, my glory days of both sports. You know, now particularly snowboarding, you know, it's all shoe companies, ski companies, racket like Yonex.
Remember when you wanted
snowboard coverage than any other snowboard company these days in the half pipe. And it's mind blowing to me, but you know, you can't stop progression.
Remember when you wanted to throw up in your mouth and you found out that K2 made their first snowboard?
Oh dude, you know what? And I ride a K2 reissue Daniel
Back
Frank pro model then. Right now, much to my chagrin. But
well, see,
when I was a kid, I wanted that board so bad, especially it was dropped when I was living in Scandinavia. And I didn't have the personal income to invest in it at the time. So I got stuck with a Kemper that I sawed the nose off of to make it look like that board.
I was thinking about this the other day. I can understand why people would frown upon quote unquote gatekeeping. And I understand, hey, you know, when it comes to music or movies or whatever, live and let live. But the reason Gen Xers are such gatekeepers when it comes to certain things like skateboarding or snowboarding or punk music or underground hip hop is because we caught such a truckload of bullshit from every other kid in the school who thought you were a fucking nerd because you skateboarded. Or I remember I was in seventh grade because my brother's 4 years older than me. We lived off in Columbus, right downstream OSU campus. Long before Downward Spiral came out, long before, right around when Pretty Hate Machine, I wore a shirt with a big orange N on the front. This stood for, it was the cover of Nine Inch Nails' Broken album. What's that N stand for? Nerd. People just tearing me in, wearing Red Hot Chili Pepper shirts from Uplift Mojo Party Pan, Freaky Stallion. Oh, Red Hot, what the hell? Getting just lambasted by my entire middle school. 2.5 years later, Under the Bridge came out. Everybody's singing Red Hot Chili Peppers and Downward Spiral came out. It's like, I get it. You guys like the band that I like, and I'm not gatekeeping because I'm mad they sold out. I'm gatekeeping because you were the same pricks. You were damn near running me out of school for wearing a goddamn t-shirt. And that's why a lot of us are still, even in our 40s, sometimes we're not as bad as we are. But especially now, you're just seeing all these kids walking around these 70s, 80s, and 90s band shirts, honestly. Just name one song, but they won't because they can't. But no, and that's why you'll run into Gen Xers who are still kind of gatekeepers this day, just because we cut such a rash of shit for the stuff we did or listened to. And then 20 years later, when it became socially acceptable, it's like, well, where's my pound of flesh? Because I sure took an ass whooping for it.
Yeah, you know, well, and we also, you know, we had insight into, it was just a great period in between the, you know, how kind of disgusting and monetarily focused the 80s were. And then, you know, with as the late 90s came in and MTV was really pushing these boy bands and Britney Spears, and nothing against them. Everyone, they all did great at what they did, but there really was that dark period of time in the early 90s into the mid late 90s where, if you were into those things, punk rock, skateboarding and snowboarding, and were deeply obsessed with them, you had this insight into this world that just nobody really was able to tap into or understand. And then, and Terry Hawkinson, who was, our Wayne Gretzky or Michael Jordan of snowboarding at the time, he said it. He said the Olympics in 1998 were going to destroy snowboarding as we knew it. And it did. And you could see kind of the cracks in our protection kind of start opening up. And, lo and behold, it's skateboarding's an Olympic sport now, and all the power to it. The few athletes that do get paid deserve to get paid, and, mm-hmm. and those, they have to be on that world-class platform to be able to achieve that. But, like I said, it was something very special that not very many of us, yes, there was millions of us, but really on a massive yeah. scale, there was very few people that
almost 2%
were in the know at the time, right? Yeah.
Well, and so I started skating or started snow. I skateboarded for 18 years, snowboarded for 17 years. I basically gave up both when I turned 22. Well, snowboarding, I gave up later. I left from Ohio to California in 2001, and that was a dream come true to me because growing up in Ohio skateboarding, what do you want to do? I want to live in California. So sadly, I had stopped skating by then, but I was still snowboarding. So I went up to Big Bear and I went to Mountain High, and then I found out, hey, I'm probably going to be moving to Florida. Well, shit. There goes my snowboarding days. And so I went snowboarding at Mountain High like every night after work. I worked in La Habra, California. We drive up outside of Pomona where Mountain High was. Here's how long it's been since I've snowboarded. My last pro model deck was the Jim Rippey. I think this was a 2001, 2002 Jim Rippey.
Instead of a sparkly top sheet?
Yep. With the koi fish.
Yes.
That board was hard to come by because in Ohio, the year before, that Jim Rippey model sold out because he was the first one to do backflips off of mountains. And his pro model sold out everywhere. You cannot find it. So the following year when that came out, I was on a waiting list. And talk about an interesting turn of events for him, the way he went in his life. But Jim Rippey was huge at the time.
Yeah, and Jim Rippey, he was kind of like the Bob Burnquist of snowboarding, where he was the first one to really take that, I'm not just a board athlete. I'm going to jump out of the planes and
double backflips and all that stuff.
And you mentioned Jim Rippey and the backflip. Well, Jim Rippey was the first person to ever do a backflip on Skidoo. It wasn't a pro sled.
Yes. Full size.
It really, when I saw that, I think that it was Standard Films TV7 or TV8. Mm-hmm. And this was in a time when premieres for snowboard videos, you'd wait 12 months to see the new snowboard video and see what the hell everyone had been doing for the past 12 months. It wasn't YouTube culture of every day.
No, we all had a VHS library in our house.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody could tell you what their favorite video was at that time. I mean, yeah.
It was gnarly, for sure. And, there was the MacDog versus Standard Film kind of battles that we'd have. And, but back in Banff, where I was living in the late 90s, the Wild Bill's was basically the bar there that would host the snowboard premieres. And, their SNFU would play before they dropped the movie. And then the movie had come out and, there'd be fucking 500 of us crammed into the sweaty bar mm-hmm. cheering a TV screen. And it's just, it's something that just seems so outlandish nowadays. It would just never happen. But this was happening in, tourist town, ski tourist town pockets all across the world at the time, basically within the same week, because these movies would come out basically on a schedule every September, something like that at the time.
And the female pro snowboarder community
was
super
jealous.
I was going to say, picture this. 16-year-old Don, junior in high school, Sun Sports, Dublin, Ohio, meet and greet, autograph with Victoria Jellilois. I still have So, I mean, one, the one of the few, and she was easy on the eyes. And being a young high school boy, I still have her autograph in here. I actually got to meet her at SunSport Skate Shop where I bought my snowboards because she was there doing autograph signings. It was like the first celebrity I'd ever met, and I still have her autograph.
Her style, especially free riding, was just unbelievable. Just so natural. Morgan LaFont, sorry, I'm going to leave out a few, but Carabeth Burnside, who came out from skateboarding and skating bowls, really is the only pro female skater, I think, in the early 90s. Tina Basich was fantastic at the time. And then really when Tara Dakitas dropped, was it technical difficulties? And she shared a part maybe with Kevin Jones. And she was jumping on rails and actually backflipped off this up rail.
Yeah.
And board slid off this little step down cliffer. And, she had a pretty short lived career. I think her career ended like doing a big air stunt or something on David Letterman in downtown New York City, only like 10 years later. And it was super unfortunate, but she really opened up female snowboarding single handedly. To where it is now.
Plus, back then, they were doing stuff on snowboards that boards weren't designed per se to do. I mean, it was easy to blow out an edge during handrails back then and not being careful with, you know, how you're riding. And as time went on and computer development came out, they fine-tuned them more to depending on what style now. You don't just buy an all-around board. You know, back in the day, I'm going to buy something that's not super long, not super short. It's an all-around board because I can only afford one. And now it's, your slope style, you need, here's a line for you. Oh, you're doing park, here's a line for you. Oh, you're doing, you know, power riding, here's a line for you. The boards are actually designed for whatever type of riding you're doing, which back then we all kind of had universal boards, and it was, let's see what we can make a son of a bitch do.
Yeah, that's just it, right? And, the pioneers of the the jib segment, if you will, or rail sliding segment of snowboarding, it was cool to us, but when you want to talk about gatekeepers, well, the older gatekeepers of snowboarding had, number one, they're scared to do it, or just they didn't grow up jumping on handrails, but they were not down. And you get these like urban myths going, oh dude, you can't slide further than 50 feet because then the edge is going to start peeling off the board because it gets too hot, and all this bullshit that they kept feeding us. But me and the crew in Banff and in Calgary, save like a couple guys that are a couple years older than us and really set the ground in that area. We're really some of the first ones jumping on the handrails, and we didn't have bungee cords. We had literally packed snow in the back of like our one buddy's truck and have like an old door that somebody ripped off of their rental house's living room. And we'd use that as a bank to go into these handrails. And at the time it was just like, who can get down this fucking thing? Like how many tricks do you have on it? It was just like, whatever it takes for you to get to the bottom.
It was the snow equivalent of what we did. Where, hey, grab a truck. We're going to steal these three parking blocks, and there's a old lamppost over there. Let's go make a handrail somewhere. It was the same thing, but on snow.
It was fantastic, actually. I loved it. Those were some of the best days. And, we'd be out there 2 a.m. high on Tim Hortons coffee. And, the cops would give us tickets for stunting.
Yeah.
Which was just absolutely hilarious. But, again, to see what that turned into, Nixon watches and their Jib Fest era and all that really had a lot of participation in the growth of it, and the whole forum team and that whole MacDog side of things for sure. But it's a beautiful thing.
Have you seen the documentary on Netflix called The River Runner?
No.
Watch it. It's about kayaking, but it's about the bad boy of kayaking from the 90s. And how him and all his guys, he made a film company. They're basically making snowboard and skateboard equivalent videos in the kayaking realm. And it's about him now. Now he's in his 40s and his last goal in life. But they're showing this footage. And I'm telling you, you're going to feel like you just got done watching a skate video. Even though it's about kayaking, it has that same footage, that same music style, the same whole lifestyle is there. And not only that, it's just a damn great and sad documentary. So check it out. Even if you're not into kayaking, just watching this thing, you'll get throwback memories to the old skate videos and all that you used to watch. And as we all did, we all got older. We all packed on weight and had lifestyle changes. And so that's what I want to get to next. But first, I want to thank everybody for listening to this episode of the Fail to Fail podcast. If you want to help out what we're doing here and what we do over at Digital 410 Media, please head over to failtofail.com or even d-410.com. That's a hyphen, a dash, if you will. And click on that Patreon link. You can sign up. It only costs you $1 a month. There's some other plans on there, but we don't care about that. We'll be happy with just your $1 a month, and that goes to pay for our online streaming service that allows us to stream all the multiple platforms like we're doing right now, web hosting and all that stuff. So go like, subscribe, sign up to $1 a month. And while you're there, please click on that YouTube link. Go like and subscribe our YouTube channel where you can see all our live stream videos, fishing videos, World War II content, and the like. And now that we got all the plugs out of the way, was there a period that skateboarding just fell out of your lifestyle and what you're doing, like it does most of us?
Not rewind again, but some of the very first core skate snow videos that, you know, myself and my peers grew up with, they were called Whiskey. Mm-hmm. It was the Whiskey series.
I think I had Whiskey 3. Yeah.
I think even 4, Todd Bowman, The Party's Over, it might have been called. Anyways.
Which one was the one where they had the old beat up Nova and they're running over street signs? And he's like, it's just a giant skateboard bumper car to me, man. I remember we were watching. My dad walked in. He's like, what the fuck are you guys watching?
Yeah, it was essentially the Canadian Jackass. Yep. About 5 years before Jackass. And, it was more breaking beer bottles over your head and puking than skateboarding and snowboarding. And, you know, for me, when those dropped, I was too young to really understand how gnarly it was as far as lifestyle choices of the people who were watching. And we glorified it for sure. Mm-hmm. When number 2 and 3 came out, I was playing hockey in Saskatchewan with future NHLers like Brad Richards and Vince LeCavalier. And for me, my head was, I need to get out of here and I need to move to Banff or Whistler and start breaking some bottles over my head so I can be a pro snowboarder. it became such a glorified aspect. So, you know, the party part of snowboarding and skateboarding was just so massive. And I think there was just a general big binge culture in the late 90s, early 2000s, but, you know, particularly in our sports. And, I remember in my early 20s showing up at Millennium Park in Calgary. It was maybe one of the biggest concrete parks in the world when it got built in 2000, 2001. And, I'd have 3 beers in me and have a drag of a cigarette, and I couldn't even skate. Like, I just, it really hindered my athletic performance. And, soon I wasn't even skating. You know, snowboarding is fantastically easier than skateboarding on any single day. So I was able to, you know, get by and shit. But, you know, I was smoking an eighth of weed a day or every 2 days. I was easily drinking 6 to 10 beers.
And not to belay the point, but we're not talking about the stuff people are getting from dispensaries. We're talking about seeds and stems and straight up dirt. It was dirt.
Yeah,
that's
you know
all
what?
You could that find was dirt.
It was before strains. It was before indica or sativa. It was before I wouldn't know what CBD was for 20 years. So this was just like purely, you know, no culture. I literally smoked as much weed in my Jetta as I could to make sure that everybody around me knew that I was reeking of weed, because I just associated it with those cultures, especially stepping outside of hockey as soon as I graduated. Whether that was a choice of mine or not, I suffered a significant head injury in my senior year of high school by, again, another future NHLer, Jarrett Stoll, caught me with a hell of a hit to the head. And at the time, Paul Kariya and Eric Lindros had just been knocked out of hockey with their concussions. And everyone was kind of freaked out about letting me pursue my hockey career as well as me. But I kind of took that as an excuse to walk away from hockey. And, you know, I could compete in snowboarding, and there was no doctors or anybody to tell me I couldn't. You know, there's no team management or anything like that. So at the time, I just say, it's crazy to think in hindsight that after a severe head injury, I used that as an excuse to drink myself and smoke myself into stupors on a very chronic basis. But to me, again, it was part of the dark aspect of the culture that I just really wanted to be a part of. And really it was, when I saw, you know, the people that I looked up to, at the time doing. So, coming from, like I said, a very conservative prairie, hockey family, all I wanted to do is be a stoner in the mountains, hucking fives and sevens. And, and I was able to accomplish that, but, you know, in hindsight, talk about having some low fucking expectations of yourself. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, I went full head deep into, the party aspect of snowboarding and skateboarding. So like I said, you know, I couldn't even skate anymore, nor had a desire to. Skateboarding was progressing so fantastically fast at that time too. So every single year, it was just like, it's never going to get bigger than this. It's never going to get gnarlier than this. And sure enough, you know, as it always does, it did. And, with snowboarding, you know, the wheels are attached to your feet. So I was able to fake it. But, you know, weed and booze turned into booze and hard drugs. And I woke up at 26, 27, and I hadn't even been snowboarding for a couple of years at that point. I started working for Red Bull in that time as a sales rep in the Banff tourist town area as well. And, all my friends were local Banff guys. A couple of them had opened up bars, and the others had been managing in bars then. And so, you know, no line, no cover, free drinks, free food.
It's like playing in a band without playing in the band.
Exactly. Right. It was very high profile, and it was like living the high school life for, you know, a decade in my 20s that I didn't really get to experience because I was so focused on hockey in the mid 90s there.
Yeah. For me, it was, after high school, a buddy of mine had a band, and I was a shitty bass player and a decent songwriter and a horrible singer, but did that for years. So the skateboarding thing just, women, rock and roll, party, and that was what it was all about up until I moved to California. But and that's where a lot of people go that way. It's just like, oh, skateboarding is something I did in high school. It's something I did in my late teens, but I'm moving on to this thing now. And some people would keep it behind the bench seat of their truck and maybe bust out every once in a while, but it just got fewer and fewer and fewer, more and more far between. And plus, by that time, when you're riding dirty, per se, you don't want to be out participating in parking lots where an annoyed officer might find something on you that's going to turn your skate session into a bigger deal. So why risk it when you can just go home and watch some TV and sit on your couch and burn one down?
Yeah, that's just it, right? And, and especially in tourist towns, in ski tourist towns, you know, like Banff is just, everyone lived like a short walk away. You never had to get into a car. Half our friends at Rude Boys didn't even get their driver's licenses ever in their adult lives. Cause why would you? Right. And, it was such an easy, from my apartment window, I'd try to go to bed at 10 PM, like a sensible time. And if I didn't fall asleep right away, I could look out my window and I could see who was bartending at three different bars: Bruno's, Devil's Gap, Wild Bill's, the Rosencrantz, four bars. I could see who was bartending and go, oh fuck, I'll get free drinks there right now in 5 minutes. And I was out of bed and on my way. And,
I just had a thought, you're talking about that culture and just everything. And I just had a thought. It's so funny we hear this phrase, free roam children. Oh, you guys were free roam children. I was such a free roam child that I lived in Columbus, Ohio. My brother was living in Big Sky, Montana, making omelets in the morning and skateboarding all day. My dad, for Christmas vacation, bought me a Greyhound ticket at the age of 17. My sister went out and got me that snowboard the night before because I blew the rails out of my 93 Burton. how many people today would put their 17-year-old kid on a Greyhound bus to go five states over to go visit his brother? So I got stuck in North Dakota during the blizzard of 1997 because we got off the interstate and couldn't get back on. And so Greyhound had to flip rooms for us, and it was like looked like a brothel from the 1800s. Like it had a communal bathroom on each floor, and the rest was just like single-room hotels. Anyhow, the reason I bring this up is we're talking about the lifestyle and all that, and this reminded me. Gen Xers are so into the you don't snitch on your boys. My brother worked at the ski resort. He was an omelet cook. I was there for a week. My lift pass expired my last day there. My brother wakes me up. Come on, we're going riding. Can't do my lift tickets expired, and I got to catch the bus in 5 hours, get down to the Greyhound. Don't worry. Eric's working the chairlift. Are you sure? Yeah, Eric's working the chairlift. Go down there. Yeah, Eric's working the chairlift. They scoot me past the turnstile, make it up the goddamn mountain. Halfway down, I get pulled over by ski patrol. Some Karen reported me. You jumped the turnstile. No, I didn't. Passing late through. I got arrested for criminal trespassing. Now, I could have said, hey, my brother works here. Him and his buddy Eric was working the turnstiles. He got me through. No, I kept my fucking mouth shut, and I took the hit. I don't know if it's the same way it is now as it was in the 90s, but in the 90s, if you got arrested in Montana because it was such a sparse area, you could pay your bond on the spot because they knew how hard it would be for some people to have to travel 100 miles to go to court. And so my brother went around to all the employee dorms and raised like $250 for me to get bailed out so I can make it to my freaking Greyhound bus that night. And luckily, when I got back to Ohio, I had a Wendy's paycheck waiting on me so I could pay all those people back. But I didn't sell. I didn't sell anybody out. And back to that whole 90s snowboard culture. I had the long hair down past my shoulder, the undercuts, handcuffed in my Burton green pants, my long Alien Workshop shirt being escorted down Big Sky Montana sidewalk. And all these skiers just looking at me like, yep, there goes another one. Took me to the truck, like, what do you want to do? I said, pay bail. I got a Greyhound to catch. Didn't sell anybody out, man. I just took the lick and took it. But, you know, it was such a lifestyle thing. It was, hey, your pass is expired, man, but it's a powder day. We got to go. So, okay, here we are. But thanks for getting me put in jail, Dick.
That's unbelievable. Yep. You know, that's one thing I can say. I never ended up in a drunk tank or any jail trouble.
Criminal trespassing. And you know what the bitch of it was? Is when I was in the main office and they're waiting for the cops, ski patrol coming in. Oh, so-and-so lift got hit by lightning last night. And I was like, see, I told you the lift let me through. I told you it was a malfunction because they're like replacing parts. Like, no, that lift worked just fine. Like, son of a bitch. I had to call my mom. It was call my dad. Yeah, I'm getting arrested, by the way, because I was 18 at that point. So no, I was 17. Yeah. No, I just turned 18. I turned 18 my senior year of high school. So, but yeah, I got arrested for criminal trespassing in Montana because my brother wanted to go snowboarding one extra day.
That's wild. Yeah, Montana's it's wild country out there.
And so you've given it up. You're living that hard lifestyle. And with whiskey and booze and cigarettes comes bad eating and just comes bad lifestyle altogether, man.
Yeah, you know, boy, and like I said, you know, everyone worked at the pub, so, and you know, I didn't have the knowledge or nor cared to listen to any, you know, local hippie about nutrition. So I was eating beef dips and burgers and pizza and, you know, I literally like gas station sandwiches because it was cheap, whatever we could shove into our bodies before we did a whole bunch of blow for the, you know, remainder of the day and into the next day. So it was at the time, like I thought it was the greatest lifestyle in the world.
Fast metabolism, things are going good.
And it catches up to you for sure. And you know, there's
right around 35. Right around 35 is when it all catches up to you. Next thing you know, you're shopping for a size 38 pant. You're like, what the fuck happened?
Yeah. Well, you know what? And I blew up. So I knew I had to get out of Banff. And it was at 31. My dad was, you know, he had accomplished so much and in his hockey career, and he took a job. Steve Yzerman became the GM of the Tampa Bay Lightning, and Yzerman wanted my old man to come join the coaching staff there, and he went down there, and it was almost like a retirement gig for him. It's going to be his last few years, I really think. And in the first playoffs that year, he had a headache, and they got him into the hospital, you know, through the Lightning connections or whatever. And they had a quick biopsy, and he had a brain tumor. And,
oh shit!
He unfortunately passed away within 24 months of that finding that out. And you know, it was so devastating, the news that he got this terminal cancer. It was right at the same time, one of my best friends and snowboard idols, Pete Nevin, he was fighting a brain tumor as well. It was coming and going, and you know, he had surgery, and you know, it was corrected and gone, and then it came back, and Pete ended up dying at like 42, I think, only like 6 months after my dad died. And it was just, it was overwhelming. And I left Banff and took a job with Sleeman Breweries, who I'm employed by still to this day.
Not to cut you off, but that's got to be so hard, because I went through a similar issue where my uncle was in the hospital. He had a pulmonary embolism in his brain. My cousin came down to see him on life support. My stepmom got up to clean the house for him. 2 hours later, she's on life support because she had a embolism in her lung. And so I know to go through that it's, when you lose a parent, that is life changing, but you still somewhat have that age difference. But to go through that and then have someone of your contemporary go through the same thing, that's really when you open your eyes and start to think, okay, that guy was my age. We live the same lifestyle. Maybe I need to reevaluate.
Yeah, it was gnarly. Unfortunately for me, you know, and Pete was, he was a kind of a generation above me. I think he was four or five years older than me, but, it sent, both those deaths sent me into an already, you know, from a bad situation into an already, more vicious spiral down. And, you know, I left Red Bull after 8 years and became a beer rep out on Vancouver Island. So as soon as I get there, you know, I'm emotionally devastated. I'm out of shape. I'm years into drug abuse and poor nutrition, and very, very much gone from the athletic, teenager that I was as a hockey player pursuing that career. So, you know, I show up on Vancouver Island, not knowing anybody. And, I've got this beer MasterCard, free beer. Beer's literally cheaper than water for me. Mm-hmm. It, you know, any pub that serves my beer, I can eat there for free. So it's just beef dips, French fries, hamburgers, whatever. And I ballooned up to 245 pounds at my peak. And basically stayed there for most of my 30s. You know, and I made some really great friends out there. Unfortunately, they enjoyed the same,
lifestyle,
late night leisures as me. They were, you know, they weren't, snowboarders or skateboarders. They're all musicians. But you know, and very grounded people, but same vices as I had.
Same community.
And so it followed me there. And, you know, it wasn't until my wife and I had, our son Hugo, that, you know, after being there for a year, and I thought that having a son would change me immediately, and it really didn't. So after being there for a year, I just was like, fuck, dude, like I can't be here, just like I couldn't be in Banff. We were pretty isolated out there from family. My wife Brendine's family were all in Regina. She's got these just salt of the earth parents, you know, prairie parents with just fantastic values and just kind hearts. And it felt like a crime keeping our son away from their influence, and keeping me in the influences that were around me. So, you know, my wife didn't want to come back to the winters of the prairies. But that was part of that grown-up sacrifice that we were willing to make to give our son a better life. And we got here. I showed up in late December 2019. Brendine and Hugo showed up in I think early January, something like that. And then we stayed at our parents' house while we looked for a house to buy out here. And we took possession of our house February 15th that year. And as we all know,
COVID
March
hit.
15th was basically the first lockdown, I believe, maybe March 13th. So,
I want to pause. I want to pause right there, real quick, just before we go too far over something you said. A lot of people, this gets, people recognize this in college athletes who are football players or swimmers, but to go from being something, I'm a skateboarder, I'm a hockey player, I'm a snowboarder, I'm in a band, to go from being something when your entire identity is based around being something to all of a sudden just being Joe Schmo, that it does have an impact on people. You miss the skateboarding, and not just the skateboarding, but being a skateboarder or being a snowboarder or once again a football player. And so people, they'll notice that next college athletes, but it doesn't matter if even if you did off the grid sports like that, going from being a something to just being a regular Joe, it can impact you sometimes.
I still really don't know anybody out here.
Yeah.
If anybody that watches my TikToks, it's just, I prop my camera up against my backpack and it's just me out there. Right.
Solo
and,
sport.
It's just, we got here and COVID lockdowns happened almost immediately. And even when we got here, I was drinking 10 to 15 beers a day, a bag of Ripple chips for dinner and just in a very unhealthy position, physically and mentally, super dark. And about a month into COVID, April of that year, I can't say it was an epiphany. I just decided I can't fucking do this anymore. I'm going to die if this, if I see what's happening around me, around the world and what's going on. And this is going to kill me. And I need to be here for my son and my wife and for myself. And I remember going, okay, I'm just going to have a few beers a day. And you know what? I never got hung over again after that day. But, for the next 8 weeks, I guess, up until my 40th birthday, I had two beers. We had some greasy prairie pizza. And I didn't drink until camping on Canada Day long weekend. It's right before the 4th of July, July 1st. And my work had given me a bottle of champagne for my 40th birthday. And
nice.
So we're camping and around the campfire. I said, hey, let's crack this open and toast to just us and the nature around us. And I woke up with a hangover the next day and not a big one, but just like enough to be like, this is fucking not worth it. And just, it's getting silly. That was the last time I had a drink. And it's phenomenal. Again, I was always able to accomplish something when I put my mind to it, but the ripple effect of not waking up hungover or even a little bit of
dehydrated,
it just domino affected. So, even in my gnarliest, I was always known for somebody that woke up early,
yeah.
Generally. And, I started waking up at 5, 6 a.m. with nothing to do. And so I had some sneakers, some like literally the only pair of non-skateboard shoes I had for like 20 years. And it was my brother owned a skateboard shop in Calgary at the time. And Etnies had come out with these like cross trainers. And
really?
He's like, here, have these. And they weren't meant for running. They were meant for like pickleball or something.
Sure.
And I just threw them on and I started running and it wasn't pretty.
Yeah. Shin splints, lower back.
Because
of the shoes.
I've glossed over this, but I had chronic back problems from pretty much the time when my dad was diagnosed with cancer until this period. And
it's funny
to the
you
point
say
where like we'd be on vacation in Mexico and I'd be sleeping on the concrete floor the whole trip. and being poolside, just drinking the pain away. All I couldn't even enjoy trips and shit. So
no, it was funny.
I was going to in that regard too.
I was going to joke earlier when you're talking about, you know, deciding that you want to quit. I was like, well, you know, after you've pulled your back out for the third time putting on your shoe, we've all been there. And it's crazy because I used to deal with a lot of back pain too. And so did you maintain the running, or did you like, oh, this ain't going to work for me?
No, you know what? So I ran through the pain. Mm-hmm. Actually, I felt comfort while I was running.
Got to get to mile three. Mile three, then your body goes numb, then you can go further.
Yeah, you know what? Like, I think at that point it was like, and I don't know what the conversion is into miles, but I was doing like 2 kilometers.
Okay,
you know, like
so 5K is 3.2 miles for us, so a little over a mile and a half.
Right. So, like, I don't know, and maybe it'd take me 15 or 20 minutes to do that or something like that.
Well, no one gets up and runs a 10 minute mile. I mean, when I first started, because that was me too. You know, I got up to 245, shopping for a size 38 pant, and ended up in the hospital with 2 kidney stones because I was running a business, working in terrestrial radio, getting up at 7 in the morning, working till 7 on the radio, and then going back to work. So I was literally consuming 3 Monster Whites, a bottle of 5-Hour Energy, and 3 Mountain Dews a day for like 5 years, and I ended up in the hospital with 2 2-millimeter kidney stones, and that was it for me. That was my turning point. And so the running is what started for me too. And one of the things about running that people don't think a lot of, if you have a lot on your mind and you want to process something, even if you don't run, just start walking. You will get a lot of shit sorted out in your head if you do a 3-mile run real quick. Oh,
yeah, you're dead right. And I read this. I picked up this book. I must have just been YouTubing, you know, how to cure back pain. And there's this book that came out in 1989 by Dr. John Sarno. It's called How to Heal Back Pain. Like as obvious of a title as you could ever ask for.
Yeah.
And it's all completely mental. I'm not going to get into it. I recommend related. It to any listener that has struggles with back pain, sciatic, mm-hmm. any kind of joint pain, because the lessons in this book, and it's such an easy 200 page read. I was convinced that this book, after spending thousands and tens of thousands of dollars on acupuncture, massage. I let this guy in Chinatown, Victoria, bloodlet the back of my legs. He sliced the back of my legs. He said that would help.
What, was he out of leeches that day?
Dude, yeah, right. Like literally. But that, you know, that's a metaphor for how far I went
for
trying to heal my back. By the time I was at page 185 of this book, my back was completely healed. And I remember the morning, it was September 22nd, and I early morning run, the moon's still up, it's dark out, and this song by the band Nothington came on, a punk band by BYO Records, and it's kind of got this emo connotations and the lyricism, and I was looking up at this full moon, and I just started sobbing mid-run, just crying uncontrollably, and when I got home, my back was fine.
Mm-hmm. You let it all out.
Since then, I've been building half pipes in my backyard. I've been shoveling for old ladies in my community. I've never had a back problem since, or even like, it's a fantastic reality. And not just like the comfort that I have and that my family has and not having to deal with, you know, chronic back pain anymore, but the thought that life is a little bit more magical than I gave it credit for by reading a book and, you know, rethinking ideology, you know, and understanding that I don't have everything all figured out and that life isn't as dark as I necessarily thought it was. You know, it uplifted my spirit. And if it wasn't for that moment, I don't know. Like it gave me it was just like another reason to not drink, to stay sober, to, you know, stay the course. And my last, my 40th birthday was June 16th. You know, my last drink was 2 weeks after that. I was probably about, I'd lost significant weight in that little time. So I was probably at 210 pounds.
Yeah.
And by mid-October,
how tall are you?
I'm 6 foot. Even.
Okay.
And by mid-October, I was 165.
Wow, that's damn skinny. At my skinniest, yeah,
it was. I became so focused on running.
Well, it's because you got an addictive personality.
I do. So and through YouTube again, the magic of YouTube, I discovered Rich Roll, a vegan long distance runner,
mm-hmm.
Who was overweight alcoholic at 39, and at 43, 44, he was on the cover of Men's Health.
Wow.
And his podcast was phenomenal. And through his podcast, it actually, I think he was the first person I saw interview Andrew Huberman. I could be mistaken, but if you're not familiar with Andrew Huberman, leading neuroscientist who actually skateboarded at EMB in San Francisco with the Carroll brothers in the early 90s, but never had a skateboard career in front of him and took off in neuroscience. It's just this crazy story of synchronicity in all of our skate lives. But you know, and all that really, like, I started creating this like YouTube world of people that inspired me. And so I would, you know, just devour information by, you know, interviews of Tom Bilyeu's, Andrew Huberman's, Rich Roll's. I started breathing with Wim Hof. I downloaded his app. Ice baths, ice showers.
You know, you're in a wormhole when the Barkley Marathon shows up as a suggested video. You're like, what?